I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Want to feel more confident with your finances this year? If you have 60 seconds, I can show you how quick and easy it is to start building healthy money habits that could last you the entire year just by using Rocket Money. Step 1, download Rocket Money. Step 2, link all your accounts and see your entire spending picture, your subscriptions, your upcoming bills, your due dates, everything. Step 3, tap a subscription you don't use and cancel it. Boom! That's money back every single month. Step 4, create a financial goal for something you want to save for, whether it be a vacation, a retirement account, or a pet's birthday. We don't judge. Now let the app automatically move small amounts of cash towards your goal. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you saved. Similar to the over 10 million members on the app that have saved up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Use the savings challenge as one step closer to feeling better about your finances today at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. One more time, it's rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Astonishing Legends Network.
Welcome back, everybody. So glad you're here. Boy, have I been hearing from the Brightwood class of 1980. I don't know. Somebody put the word out. They're texting each other. There have been phone calls, a lot of activity on Facebook pages. This class is not done. these kids were wild 40 years ago, and it hasn't stopped. There's a reunion planned for August, which I cannot make it to. I'm saying that right now. I don't know who's going to be there, but maybe it's better I'm not. I don't know what they have planned. Anyway, no one from my current life has commented on any content of this podcast at all. But let me tell you, those 12-year-olds from 40 years ago, I have stirred up a hornet's nest. Well, let's keep going. I'm very excited about tonight's episode. So here we go. Miracles by D. Scott Rogo, Part 2. Bilocation. The state of being or ability to be in two places at the same time. It is Monday, October 8th, 2001, and it is quiet. I sit in my big leather recliner in the almost empty living room of the house I'm renting on Queensberry Road. I look out at the street through gauzy white curtains. Nothing moves. In the distance, I hear a high school marching band. It is the only sound, and it makes the relative silence all the more profound. I moved in on Saturday. There wasn't much to move. This chair, a bed, and 22 boxes of books. I sit in the silence and I can feel myself starting to unclench. This is the first time in my life I have ever lived on my own. No roommate, no girlfriend, no wife, no kids, no dogs. I am almost 35. The past month has been quiet if you don't turn on the television. It's the kind of quiet that follows a gunshot, a shocked waiting silence. Megan from Spyglass called me on September 13th to check on me. There have been a lot of these kinds of phone calls in the past month. Yes, I'm okay. No, I didn't know anyone in the towers. When we finally got around to miracles, she told me that Touchstone wanted to meet to discuss a reapproach to the material. Usually this sort of phrase would completely undo me, but my life and the whole world seemed to be in a mode of reapproach. At the meeting in mid-September, it was decided that the romantic tone of the story, left over from the feature film script, didn't reflect where we wanted to go with the series. And recent events regarding the Catholic Church that had been in the news, most of it about child molestation, had made the idea of centering our series on the secret inner workings of the Vatican unpalatable. Megan and I spent a few days designing a totally new pilot story that still maintained the structure of A, Paul Callan, a disillusioned young seminarian, investigates miracles for the church and discovers it's a bummer, and B, he investigates a new case that turns out to be totally legit, but also weirdly sinister. The case that makes up the bulk of the pilot would now be Paul's investigation of a terminally ill young boy who can heal people, but whose own condition worsens each time he does. Is this the work of God, the devil, or something else? In the new version of our story, Paul brings the evidence of this miracle to the Monsignor of his diocese and is shocked to learn that the Monsignor doesn't plan to follow up. He's going to bury it. He's not interested in promoting the notion of miracles because he thinks it makes the church look foolish and primitive. Crestfallen and emotionally gut-punched, Paul quits. But then, in the final minutes of the pilot, he's approached by a mysterious man who appears to be aware of what Paul has gone through. He used to be with the church, but now he works more or less on his own, tracking supernatural phenomenon that he believes is happening more and more and points to the coming of a large event. Against his better judgment, but desperately in need of answers, Paul agrees to join him. Megan and I hadn't worked out all the details, but we had enough to go back to Touchstone, and we did. They loved it. And to be honest, so did I. The story had mystery, a surreal supernatural tone, and it involved real emotions against the backdrop of large philosophical questions. I was sent off to do an entirely new outline, and I had a feeling this one would not suffer the fate of the last one. And even though I now had to come up with an entirely new story, I didn't mind at all. This one would be all mine. I tore through almost all the boxes of books until I finally found it. Miracles by D. Scott Rogo. It had arrived in my life 6 months ago, and I had never read a word. So much had changed in those 6 months, in my life and in the world. It was a strange time to talk about miracles, but something told me it was finally time to find out what Rogo had to say on the subject. I made a cup of coffee, set myself up in the leather armchair, opened the book, and began to read. I woke up 2 hours later, my fingers still marking my place on page one. This happened all the time now. I knew it had nothing to do with the book. It had to do with me and what was happening in my life. I was exhausted on a deep physical and emotional level. I could have slept for weeks. The last month with my wife as I prepared to move had been awful. In another one of the universe's great jokes, we had, months earlier, agreed to host a wedding at our house for a good friend in late September, and it was decided I wouldn't move out until after that happened. So the final weeks in the house were spent preparing for a wedding. Then a few days before the move, we sat Owen and Spencer down and explained to them what was about to happen. We tried to use the language we had learned from their daycare, an amazing, loving, supportive place that over the past 5 years had basically taught us how to be parents. We told the boys that Mom and Dad weren't getting along and were fighting a lot. You know, like you do with your friends sometimes, we said. So we had decided we both needed a time out. Dad would be moving into a different house, but they would get to spend every other week there. They'd have their own room and a backyard and a TV and all the other things they had at Mom's house. In fact, at Dad's house, they'd even have bunk beds. We tried to make it sound like an adventure. The boys seemed skeptical, but we took our time and answered their questions. No, Dad's house wouldn't have dogs. Yes, they could call the other parent on the phone whenever they wanted to, and even go back and forth more frequently if that's what they wanted. We told them we didn't know how long our time out was going to last, and we really didn't. We were still going to marriage counseling, and who knew how we'd feel once I moved out. I sat in my chair and listened to the marching band. I glanced at my cold cup of coffee and my miracles book in my lap. The quiet felt nurturing, soothing, like stepping out of a loud, hot factory into a cool evening breeze. No, I didn't know how long our time out would last, and yet, already, I couldn't ever picture going back. Rogo's book examines classic orders of miracles through the methods and viewpoint of a modern parapsychologist. And I was gratified to find the first of many references to Herbert Thurston's The Physical Phenomenon of Mysticism on page 15. Rogo's approach in the book is to examine some famous cases of levitation, stigmata, bilocation, you know, the hits, as well as bleeding statues, miraculous healings, and sightings of the BVM. That's Blessed Virgin Mary to you heathens out there. But he views these events from the stance of a parapsychologist, not a priest. The challenge of this sort of material, as I anticipated when the book first arrived, is the overwhelming religious bias involved in the vast majority of the cases. They are typically experienced by the holy, witnessed by believers, reported by church clerics, and described wholly in terms of the will of God. I found myself struggling to maintain interest in the cases and skimming through whole passages, when I suddenly realized that the disconnect I was experiencing was the solution to a very real problem I was having in my pilot. I had always more or less presumed that, on my show, the cases going forward would be built on the question, is it a miracle or is there a mundane real-world explanation? This worried me. It sounds good in a meeting to say, hey, you know what? Some episodes will turn out not to be miracles, and that'll be super cool. But in reality, it would not be cool at all. That's like saying, well, it's a cop show, but you know what? Some episodes, they won't solve the case, and that'll be super cool. Genre shows have rules just like law shows, doctor shows, and cop shows, and one of the rules is, you have to give us the genre. In the case of a show like Miracles, people tune in to be mesmerized by the unreal. Don't harsh our buzz or we'll stop watching. So I knew that argument was bullshit. But if we weren't doing a sort of X-Files-style believer versus skeptic, then what were we doing? Two believers? As a matter of fact, yes. Rogo's book made it clear. The exact same phenomenon can be investigated very differently depending on whether the investigator is a clergyman or a parapsychologist. One of the best examples of this is the case of the bleeding picture of Christ in the home of Abbé Vecher, a French cleric in the city of Mirabeau-en-Boitou. According to reports, not only was the picture bleeding, but so were consecrated hosts and a plaster statue of Christ erected in a nearby grotto. Everard Fielding, a British investigator for the SPR, decided to investigate. Over the course of 6 years, from 1914 to 1920, during repeated visits, Fielding found that while there was ample opportunity for fraud, it was unlikely. Early samples of the serum that seemed to spontaneously erupt from the picture and the hosts were tested and found not to be human blood, though later samples were. The phenomenon spread to other religious icons throughout the house. Finally, Fielding summed up his findings. What was happening in the Abbé's house was no miracle. It was a poltergeist. And the Abbé himself was the agent. He cited other cases from his investigations in which a poltergeist attack could be very narrow in scope and could correlate to the unconscious inner workings of the agent's psychology. One of the most compelling elements of his argument regarding Abbé Vacher was that the phenomenon seemed to follow him. On more than one occasion, when the Abbé visited other people's homes, their religious paraphernalia began to bleed. This traveling effect is common in poltergeist cases. This fascinated me, and it also gave me breathing room for constructing stories if the pilot was ever picked up to series. We could do all sorts of things: haunted houses, poltergeists, even UFOs. Rogo speculates that some famous Marian apparitions experienced by the devout could also be seen as nothing more than dazzling lights in the sky that, viewed in a non-religious context, might be identified as visitors from another planet or dimension. I loved the idea that I could have two different characters investigating legit phenomenon from two completely different philosophical points of view, and neither one had to be a skeptic. Once I finally got to work on the new outline, the story came together quickly. Each day I felt my confidence grow, and I also felt myself slip into a rhythm that was new to me. Two writing sessions per day instead of one. Now I would work from 10 a.m. to noon, then again from 2 to 4. This was only 1 hour more than my usual noon to 3. But something about it represented a change. I was on my own now. In fact, in the weeks when I didn't have my sons with me, I spent such long expanses of time alone, with no human interaction whatsoever, that for the first time in my life, I truly lost track of time. Hours lost to writing, reading, sleeping, or simply staring out a window. Nothing bad happened when I did this. No one got angry at me. The feeling that I was failing every day loosened its grip. It didn't go away entirely, but even a little relief was rapturous. For my birthday that year, on November 2nd, I traveled alone to Portland, Oregon. I ate dinner alone in loud, trendy restaurants with no companion but a book and a candle and a cocktail. And I was happy. In my hotel room at the Heathman on Broadway, I had the experience that other writers will recognize. Perfect flow, where writing becomes an unconscious act and the words arrive as dictation from a divine source. Page after page emerging with no seeming effort. This is true ecstasy. It is rare, but the few times it happens are worth all the days when writing feels like nothing more than kissing a corpse and hoping somehow it comes to life. By the time I got home on November 4th, 2001, the new outline was done. A side effect of all this was a new level of confidence and candor in marriage counseling. I started speaking all my feelings with no real concern about how they might affect my wife. Yes, I was finally being assertive, but I was also being a jerk. I wanted to start dating. I didn't want to wear my wedding ring anymore. I basically wanted to have the single life that I never had before. Obviously, this wasn't the main issue in our marriage, or even an issue. And I suppose if for me it was just about having sex, I would have gone out and had sex, but I didn't. But our marriage counselor had said that dating was usually considered on the table when people were separated. And once she did, I couldn't stop thinking about it. I realize now that this came as a painful shock to my wife, but at the time, I didn't care. I had gotten this far. I wanted to go further. And then, one day, in the counselor's office, my wife made her feelings clear. Dating was a deal breaker. If that's what I wanted to do, then it meant I didn't want to be married anymore. And if that was the case, I was going to have to say it. So once again, even as I thought I was being independent and brave and finally speaking up for myself, it was an ultimatum from her that pushed me to take the final step, a step I was too afraid to take until forced. So I said the words, "I want a divorce." It was a bad moment. My wife took off her wedding ring, threw it at me, and left the room. I was terrified. And I was furious. But mostly, I couldn't blame her. And I also couldn't shake the humiliating feeling that I wouldn't have said the words if she hadn't made me. Even in my moment of separation, I was pure, uncut chicken shit. I wrote what would be the second-to-last check to the counselor, stalled a few minutes so I wouldn't risk running into my wife in the parking lot, and then left. The script for Miracles was written from November 22nd to December 14th, 2001. Because the outline had been so detailed, the process of writing the script was basically about dialogue, timing the action within scenes, and overall flow. But the work was done against a backdrop of real fear. Because I had always operated on the notion that my job was to save my wife and that her survival depended on me, thus giving me a chance to save the mom who I couldn't save. And what is with all this saving? I was emotionally convinced that by finally leaving her, I was in some very real way abandoning her to death. I know this sounds melodramatic and self-aggrandizing, but it is absolutely what I felt, and the feeling was hard to shake. There were times growing up when my mother told me that if anything ever happened to me, she would die. I took this literally because I believed she meant it literally. She would either die of grief or kill herself. And now this feeling, perhaps unfairly, transferred to my wife. What if by leaving her, I'm killing her? My therapist knew exactly what I was going through, and she reminded me, "Your wife is not your mother, and neither one of them will die because of you. They're separate people who can control their own lives. Your decisions can have an impact, but ultimately, they control their lives, and you control your life. Don't forget that." I tried not to, but the human mind can literally change the physical world. At least according to D. Scott Rogo. In Miracles, he was pursuing what he called his parascientific approach, and it worked like this. Miracles really do happen, except they don't come from God. They come from us. Modern parapsychology, and we're talking mid-1930s to around mid-1990s, was truly focused on only two things, ESP and psychokinesis. This has to do with J.B. and Louisa Rhine's research and experiments at Duke University in the 30s, and a general rejection of ghost hunting as a serious way forward for a respectable guest at the dinner party of mainstream science. When Rogo wrote Miracles, he was attempting to explore miraculous phenomenon through this lens. He personally accepted the reality of psychokinesis, the rare ability of some humans to affect matter with the power of their mind. Sometimes the matter in question was their own body. Stigmata is defined as, quote, bodily marks, scars, or wounds corresponding to those of the crucified Jesus Christ. Some people, in the grip of religious ecstasy, do manifest these wounds and actually, literally begin bleeding from the palms of their hands, the soles of their feet, and even their scalp, where the crown of thorns was placed on Christ's head. But outside the church, this syndrome is understood to be a psychological state in which the mind causes the body to produce the phenomenon. Now, that alone is pretty amazing. But it's more a testament to the capacity of the human mind than the specific interference of God. Parapsychologist and poltergeist expert William Roll had a theory that poltergeists were not ghosts or disembodied spirits, but rather the result of what he called RSPK, recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis. On some unconscious level, the poltergeist focus or agent would create psychokinetic effects that appeared as what we commonly know as poltergeist phenomenon. An energy we still do not understand emanates from a human subject and causes objects to move about a room, or water to drip from the ceiling, or fires to start, or, in the case of Aviv Asher, paintings to bleed. With this in mind, and with our own personal experiences, it's not hard to see how certain stressful situations can induce a human body to a stomachache, or back pain, or in very extreme cases, bleeding wounds. The human mind can make the body do all kinds of crazy things that seem impossible. We've all heard stories of the mother who lifts the car off the child trapped underneath. We've all seen athletes do the impossible when the chips are down and everything rides on the next basket, touchdown, home run, or hole-in-one. What isn't possible if a person truly believes it is? In my personal world, I tried to keep watch over my thoughts. Yes, I wanted to believe I could control positive outcomes. I could produce a script that was my best work. But did that mean I could control other people's reaction to it? Of course not. And what about my wife and kids? How were my actions affecting them? I couldn't really be destroying their lives, could I? Could I avoid it, even if I wanted to? I spent my evenings on dating websites, still a new thing in 2001. Who were these people? Would they like me? Could I make them like me? Should I try? My landlord set me up with one of her other tenants, a woman who was also going through a divorce. I was so excited to be going out on a real date. I spent the whole time performing a version of myself that I was real pleased with, and then was surprised at the end of the night when she broke up with me. Basically, she said it was her, not me, but that we shouldn't have a second date, and that was that. I remember one woman who had been left by her boyfriend, a Marine. He was also the father of her six-month-old baby. After chatting online with her for an entire evening, I felt an overwhelming desire to step into her life and be the better man and marry her and raise her child as my own. My therapist literally started laughing as I described these feelings. At first I was shocked, then hurt, then I got it. It was Friday, December 14th. My script was due at Spyglass that night for a weekend read. I still had the last big scene to write. It was the majority of the fourth act. It was the scene where the mysterious man named Alva Keel, named of course after John Keel, approaches Paul and asks him to join his investigations. It was going to be a full day of work, and I wouldn't have any time for revisions. I got home from my workout that morning feeling anxious but excited. The script so far was great. I just had to nail this last scene. I walked into the house and saw the little red light on the answering machine blinking. I hit play, and within seconds felt like I was standing too close to an open furnace. It was a message from my wife, and she was very upset. I recognized the tone. I had heard it in counseling many times. If it had just been grief, I could have handled it. I could have been sympathetic. It was the anger that undid me. She said we needed to talk. She said there were things she had to say to me. As a 35-year-old adult, 5 years into therapy, I wish I could say this was all something I could deal with, but it was not. I was terrified. And I was done talking. I had this irrational fear that she was going to make me come back, and I wouldn't have the courage or the strength to say no. Suddenly, I was 3 years old, facing an oncoming hurricane of rage from my mother. I looked out my front window and scanned the street for her car. Was she driving to my house right now? I panicked. I didn't shower or even change my clothes. I threw my computer into my bag, locked every door and window in the house, and drove away. I even drove away tricky, using side streets to get me to the freeway so there would be no way our cars would pass each other on the main streets. I was on the run. She knew all the places I liked to write. The coffee lounge at Vroman's on Colorado, the Starbucks on Foothill, the Starbucks on Lake, the other Starbucks on Lake. She obviously knew my car, a big red Ford Expedition. It would be a dead giveaway. Would she really try to hunt me down? Confront me in public? I didn't think so. But I was in uncharted territory. I couldn't be sure. And if she somehow did, it would send me over the edge. Work would be an impossibility, and right now, work was the only thing in my life going right and making me feel like a sane, capable human being. Sure, I was tricky driving away from an imaginary confrontation with my wife, but still, I had to hide. I needed to find a place where I could work undisturbed, a place where there was no chance she could ever find me. I drove all the way out to Glendora, about 20 miles east of Pasadena, and found a tiny cafe on a side street that I'd never been to before. It was 9 a.m. I was a sweaty, nervous wreck. But I had 8 straight hours to work. I didn't have a cell phone then, and public access to the internet was extremely limited unless you were in a cyber cafe. And if you don't know what that is, look it up. I found a table way in the back with a view of the door and access to a back exit. I plugged in my computer and started working. And I never looked up. Aside from a ham sandwich and about 6 cappuccinos that I really, really, really did not need and should not have had, I never looked away from the screen. And I believe now that when you watch that scene, even 22 years later, you feel every bit of unhinged fear that I felt writing it. Megan had very few notes, and the script went to Touchstone on Monday. We scheduled a notes call with them for Wednesday, which is why I was so surprised when Megan called on Tuesday just after lunch and asked if I could jump on the phone with the whole team, like right now. What could I say? 2 minutes later, I was on with Suzanne Patmore and her whole team, as well as Megan. Suzanne loved the script, like really loved it. But she had an idea that she wanted to pitch to me, a change in the Act 3 climax that she felt strongly about but wasn't sure I'd go for. I was immediately on guard, but I agreed to listen and give it serious thought, whatever it was. The climax of Act 3, and the whole episode, takes place on a rainy night at a railroad crossing. Tommy, the young boy who can heal people, has been getting sicker and sicker with every healing. His dad thinks he should save whoever he can. He's going to die anyway, there's no question about it. So why not help as many people as he can before the end? The dad says it's Tommy's choice, but the mom is against it. What sort of a god would allow a little boy to heal anyone but himself? One night, she secretly bundles him up, puts him in the car, and drives away. But Paul, who's been staying at their house while investigating the case, sees this and follows in his own car. What happens next is truly horrifying. The mother's car goes out of control at the train crossing and is struck by the passing train. Paul pulls over and runs to the wrecked car to find Tommy's mom on the edge of death, but Tommy somehow uninjured. Paul and Tommy share a moment. It's clear what Tommy intends to do. The mother is too weak to stop him. Paul watches as Tommy reaches out and saves his mother's life, dying in the process. Paul knows he has witnessed a true miracle, and this is the story he brings back to the Monsignor at his church. Suzanne's idea was this. What if it's Paul's car that gets hit by the train? What if the boy dies saving Paul's life? I hated it. I didn't say that, of course. But I did mention my main problem with it, which was, if he saves Paul's life, then there's no question about the boy's abilities. Paul would be 100% convinced of the boy's supernatural powers. There would no longer be any question for our main character, no gray area of doubt. His journey would be over in the pilot. Where would he go in the series? Suzanne disagreed. Just because something supernatural happens to you, that doesn't make things clearer. The mystery is still there, maybe even more so. And of course, she was right. It was an argument I had made myself many times. Hell, it was the entire story of the Mothman prophecies. Anyway, I said I'd think about it, and we all hung up, and then Megan called me right back. She could tell I was bugged. "You don't like it, do you?" "No," I said, "I don't." "It's too much. It's too big." Then she said, "You really want to save the mom, don't you?" But I was so upset and angry and freaked out by the Touchstone phone call that I thought she said, "You really want to save your mom, don't you?" And my brain exploded. Is that what I was doing? The pilot I'd spent months working on was all about a little boy who wants to save people, and it ends with him saving his mother and dying in the process. You gotta be fucking kidding me. How had I not seen it? Could I really be that blind to my own creative process? Well, yeah, I guess I could, because I was. I said to Megan, hang on. As I tried to grapple with this realization. Okay, so what would it mean if I did it Suzanne's way? It would mean Tommy saves Paul. The boy saves the man. The child dies so the adult can move forward. Okay, I told Megan. Let me think about this. Can I call you tomorrow? We hung up and I got right to work. Not writing. I called my therapist. Could we meet tomorrow? The next day, I went through all of this in the small office that had become my personal church of transformation over the last 5 years. My therapist was as intrigued as I was. She made a point to reassure me, growth doesn't happen at the expense of the child. My inner child didn't have to die for me to move on. The trick was bringing the child along as a separate entity, one you could talk to and interact with in a sort of sympathetic time travel mode. I wanted to be able to calm that child like I would my own actual kids, and reassure him that he wasn't dying, wasn't in mortal danger, and that while he had a shitty time being a scared, helpless kid, the adult version was there to help him and never abandon him. Like most of therapy, it made a kind of intellectual sense, and I could feel the idea slowly sinking in. It didn't solve my own inner terror, but it gave me insight. And it gave me insight into Paul Callan, too. Suddenly, his character felt fuller, and his journey had more dimension and meaning. And the next day, I rewrote the third act. Now, Tommy saved Paul. The boy and the man were connected. Suzanne Patmore's instinct was 100% correct. I turned in the final draft of Miracles to the ABC network on Friday, December 21st, and promptly forgot about it. I had bigger worries. The Mothman Prophecies was going to be released in theaters on January 25th, 2002, just 1 month away. This was a major motion picture. This was way more important to my life and career than a TV pilot. This was the thing that had to work. Just imagine, if it does well, I might actually get a computer date after all. How would the world receive the Mothman Prophecies? Would ABC decide to shoot my pilot? What would my life be in 2002? I had absolutely no idea. But I knew that for some of these questions, I wouldn't have long to wait before finding out the answer. Thank you for joining me on Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. Please join me next time for the final chapter of Season 1, Miracles, Part 3. Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers, Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producer is Tess Feifel, and our sound designer, engineer, and editor is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tommy Beaver, website is by Kayla Lord, and our music, as always, is by Nima Kazaruni. Until next time, be safe and be well, find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.
realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Rocketmoney.com/cancel.